Hello. Go around and say hi to everybody. Starting with Ken in Spain, up very late with us. Katie, Linda, Franklin, Bob K, Jinryu, Ellen, Joan, Jeannie, Alice, Paul, Mark W, Sam, and a jellyfish. He always got the best backgrounds. Susan, Tyler, Marv, Sydney, Karen, Jim, Amanda, John, Tessa, Mick, Bridget, Sabrina, Alex, Drew, Erica, and Ruth Ann. All right. Nice group tonight. Announcements. Still time to sign up for the term student program. Starts March 6th, and you have to commit to an opening retreat and a closing retreat and keeping some vows in between. And you should have been regularly involved with the Sangha for several months already before you sign up, just because the program is meant to build on an already established regular Sangha practice. Geez, I don't know. I should keep a list of stuff to, or I should start a Zoom shoe. So who has to make the announcements? anything anybody else can think of that I should announce? We're starting a new class series tonight. That was what I was announcing. All right. I'll just get started then. Although I did, people have asked periodically, so I should probably just make a periodic announcement that when, you know, just like when, I mean, even the Black Plague ended, right? So when we can meet in person again, we will also have the opportunity to participate by Zoom in our main events. So it'll be, you know, it'll be a little different. There'll be some people in person, but there'll always be like a Zoom screen of people in the Zendo, so we can see who's participating and ways to interact and ask questions and stuff like that. So those of you who are from afar, I'm becoming more and more conscious of, you know, it's oftentimes like half the people that are present at our meetings are no longer local. They're all over the country. They're even all over the world. And we welcome you and value your presence. And so I'm beginning a little more self-conscious about when we go like, oh yeah, I can't wait till we meet in person again. It's like, well, half of the people here aren't really going to be joining us for that, except on rare occasions. So we will be happy to meet in person again, but we won't be leaving you behind. Any questions or other announcements or anything? Okay. So tonight we are starting foundational teaching series, and there'll be one like next week. Will actually be a student-led discussion. And out of sync of the series, because I am going to the coast to spend a few days in silence and participate remotely with the Great Vow session. I found participating in session at home just doesn't quite cut it. There's still too much to do, too many distractions. So I'm going away, and I appreciate all of you holding down the fort, while I'm away, but you will be led in an interesting discussion by Jinryu next week. So please come to that. But then, you know, so we're starting this week, and then after that, we'll continue with foundational teachings. And this is the syllabus, if you will. The schedule of the classes can be found on the website, and it's also referred to in our weekly newsletter, which if you don't already get, you know, I recommend signing up for. You can just go to the website and, you know, enter your email, and you'll get our weekly e-bulletin. So on the website, there's the list of topics by week and date, and also the recommended podcasts from my Zen Studies podcast to either listen to or read. So tonight, we're not actually starting with a teaching per se, we're starting with the teachings. So I'm going to start by giving an overview of Buddhist teachings. What do we mean by that? And what are they? How many are they? Where do they come from? That kind of whole thing. And then talking about how we relate to the teachings. You know, what are they about in Buddhism? Is it about accepting them, memorizing them? How many do you need to know? How much do you need to know? Do you need to believe it all? Like, what is it? And wrestling with the teachings. And then we will do a breakout where I'm hoping that people will be willing to share a Buddhist teaching that has really been important to your practice, you know, starting with one anyway. If you feel like you're absolutely brand new and you have no idea what the Buddhist teachings are, that is fine, just say that. But you know, if there's, doesn't matter what kind, if it's a, you know, a ancient Buddhist teaching or a sutra or a precept or something like that. So the overview of the teachings. So unlike most religions, I would say, we do not have divinely revealed scriptures. The Buddha was not divine. He was just a human being, a remarkable human being, perhaps, who, you know, discovered a way of practice, who had great spiritual insight. And he gave many teachings over the course of his life, and people remembered them and wrote them down. So he taught a practice, and what he repeatedly said was, you know, because people would try to engage him in all kinds of stuff, show us your supernatural powers, or what about this metaphysical speculation or that metaphysical speculation. He said, I've got one agenda. It's suffering and the end of suffering. Like, that's it. So he always returned to that. This is all of his, all of the teachings are aimed at that, aimed at like identifying suffering and liberating ourselves from suffering. And it was something that you need to realize and enact for yourself. So a classic example of, you know, if you feel at all like, wow, look at this big long list of Buddhist teachings, there's the four this and the eight that and the blah 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 blah, blah, and you know, volumes of sutras and whatever, according to the mythology, the Buddha's main disciple, Ananda, had, what is it, an eidetic memory? He remembered every last thing the Buddha said, remembered everything. And I mean, people really exist like that, so maybe he really was. And yet the understanding was that he still didn't really get it. As of the Buddha's death, he still was not considered, like, you know, fully realized. Even though he had all of the teachings in there, he was very smart and he knew them all. So this is a really, you know, strong message that it's not just about like knowing all this stuff or memorizing all this stuff or even accepting all this stuff. That's not where the key to Buddhism is. Plus, the Buddha left us three treasures, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And the Dharma, or the teachings, is only one of the three treasures. The Buddha, you know, what is the Buddha as a treasure? I mean, we like to say our own enlightened nature in a way. So So to some extent, one of the treasures is our own intuition and guidance, internal wisdom. And then there's the Sangha. So that's just as important as these teachings. That said, the Dharma, the formal teachings, you know, so the Buddha taught for 45 years. He gave tons and tons of teachings, and they were maintained as oral teachings for probably about 500 years before they were written down on palm leaves. And by the time they were written down, there were already different schools of Buddhism. So, you know, then it gets even more complicated. So that kind of one of the most original versions of the teachings from the time of the Buddha, we call the Pali Canon. There's other canons, but this is one version. This is the Theravadan Buddhist version. And just that, just the Buddha's words and related canonical teachings are about 12,000 pages. It's about 50 volumes of material. So, and then Buddhist schools of thought went to, you know, Buddhism traveled to different countries, different schools of thought emerged, practice diverged. So Tibet, China, Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia. Then there was the arising of the Mahayana right about the time they're writing down the Pali Canon on the palm leaves, which came up with new sutras, which claimed to be spoken by the Buddha. And people said, huh, well, that's weird. You know, here's the Pali Canon. There's nothing in there about what the Buddha said. I said, oh, well, these have been hidden for a long time under the sea, guarded by serpents or various things like that. So but they came up with ways to try to legitimize these new pieces of literature. But for those of us who were inspired by them, it doesn't matter that much where they came from. And they claimed authenticity as well. So now we have the Mahayana Sutras. The word of the Buddha always remains important. But in the nature of Buddhism, anyone who realizes the Buddha way is a legitimate teacher. So their teachings can be just as liberative and helpful as those of the Buddha himself. And the Mahayana introduced the idea of skillful liberatory, yes, skillful means. So that's how they explained their sutras. They said, well, the Buddha didn't give these teachings yet because it wasn't time. So then there became this idea that the teachings ideally are, they're framed and expressed appropriate to the audience, to the student. So it can take many different forms, and as long as it gets through, as long as it has a good effect, then your skillful means are legit. Then we get to Chan in China. So this is our Zen lineage through China that began to call itself at some point the transmission outside the scriptures. So they made a very special point of saying, what our teachers realize and then recognize that their students have realized and we pass down in this lineage is something that, you know, it's separate from the scriptures. It's not dependent on the scriptures. And this was in part a way to differentiate the school from schools that were very scholarly. So it was very much about studying sutras and memorizing sutras and stuff like that. And they really wanted to get that emphasis back to like, what is the essence of the practice? What is the essence of the realization? And this coupled with Chinese culture, which already had a sense that, you know, words can't really get at the truth. So this is something, you know, that's found in Taoism and Confucianism and other aspects of Chinese culture, that words, we call it, it's like a finger pointing at the moon, right? The words are not reality itself. They're trying to get you somewhere. They're trying to convey something that aren't the words themselves. So ironically, even though Chan With supposedly a transmission outside the scriptures, it amassed a vast literature of its own. So these were primarily teaching stories. Sometimes they're teaching poems, like we will recite during our chanting services. But a lot of them are stories of interactions between teachers and students. But these were all, again, notably, they're not to be memorized. They're like the finger pointing at the moon, right? They're like, they're pointing us towards something that we are supposed to realize for ourselves. And even now, I mean, all the way along, we're still creating new Buddhist and Zen literature. I mean, there's probably many people in the Sangha who, you know, it's actually a book or something by a contemporary teacher that has really made a difference to you as much as the ancient scriptures. And in Buddhism, that is totally, again, that's totally legit. So we have a lot of we have a lot of teachings. And all of them amazingly retain an amazing amount of consistency and harmony. Somehow there manages to be a truth. Like, people aren't just making new stuff up all the time, right? It's skillful means, and it's interpretive. It's trying to communicate something ancient to a new audience. I'm not saying there aren't people who just, you know, depart from it and make something up, but then they're not really within the school of Buddhism anymore. And this is because they're such core foundational principles. And because there's a test. is this a good teaching? Is this a legitimate teaching? And a test, you can go all the way back to the Pali Canon for a good test. So this is from the Kalama Sutta in the Pali Canon. So the Kalamas were a group of people, I guess like a cultural group, or came from a particular area. And they were troubled because there were all kinds of holy men coming through saying, yeah, you got to listen to me. I've got the truth. You know, here's my teachings. Here's my practices, da, 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 da. And so they asked the Buddha, you know, how can we know which of these are true? Which of these are truthful? Which should we listen to? So the Buddha said, now, Kalamas, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. When you know for yourselves that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should enter and remain in them. So that's it. Does it lead to liberation from suffering? Does it lead to greater wisdom? Does it lead to real happiness? Then it's consistent with Buddhism, along with, you know, a few core principles like impermanence and dukkha and stuff like that, which are the things that we'll be covering in this this series. So how much do you need to know, and where do you start? So I created a metaphor of a tree. If you figure the trunk is like the original Buddhist teachings, those core principles, the Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, most of it taught by the Buddha. That's the trunk. And then there's some really major branches. Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, really big branches, almost as big as the trunk of a small tree, right? Then they go into smaller branches. So in any given lineage, any given teacher, Zen group, or other Buddhist group, is essentially going to be at the tip of a little branch up at the top of that tree. So the teachings in these different types of Buddhism that have evolved can look very different from one another, sometimes even quite contradictory. And, for instance, we have this approach in Soto Zen of a form of meditation, which is like it's just being present with what is. You're not trying to control your meditative experience. The koan arises in daily life, whatever. If you went to a Theravadan, depending on, I mean, different groups are different, right? But you go to a Theravadan group, their form of meditation is very, you work on concentration. You're working on things. There are things that you do. It's very directed. It's very strategic. It's very, one step after another. So which is right? Right? Are we supposed to be concentrating and really working hard on clarifying certain things? Are we supposed to just be like sitting there? And it can be apparent contradictions, but I like to think of it as they're like, we're all going up the mountain, right? And there's different paths up the mountain. And you might say that there are different paths for different types of people. But you do need to pick a path if you want to get very far. So, to throw in yet another analogy, one of my teachers, Kyogen, said, it's like you're going cross country, right? And you buy a used car, and then you're, a third of the way across, and you're like, I don't know, I think I should have gotten that other car. So then you go back and you get the other car and you start driving that. But then halfway in, you're like, I don't know if this one's going to make it. I should. It's like, just gotta, you don't know. You don't, at a certain point, you just gotta like pick a car and keep going. And stop second guessing whether another one might have gotten you there faster. And in terms of study, in terms of relating to the teachings, I mean, everybody's different, and some people just love comparative religion and, studying all kinds of different things and love to see the variety, and that's fine. But it can be a little bit confusing and distracting. I mean, if you're really trying to settle into Shikantaza, I don't recommend continually going to a Theravadan center where they're giving you other recommendations. I mean, it's just counterproductive after a while. It's like, wait a second, but so to go back to my tree analogy, I think of it as, there's a lot of study that you can do, but if you want to keep it fairly constructive and straightforward, you kind of trace your branch back and study anything between the trunk and the tip of your branch. Because as you go back, there's going to be a harmony and consistency. Like there's really nothing in Zen that just, contradicts what the Buddha said. So the original, Pali Canon, Theravadan Buddhist teachings for the most part are like, okay. I mean, they're different and they may or may not resonate personally with you, but they're pretty consistent as opposed to, picking from along the tips of the branches. And then once you're kind of if you're kind of sticking to that, and again, if you like to depart from that, that's fine. There's learning the core principles. The foundational teachings, which not I'm not going to present all of them in this course, but the core ones. And so it's not an infinite list, even though there are infinite Buddhist teachings. It's not the core foundational principles are pretty limited. And then you follow your nose. And it's like there's not a real curriculum of study, even though sometimes people want that. It's really like, I used to really, once again, we'll do it, right? Go to the bookstore, go to the Buddhist section, and just kind of pick stuff off the shelf and like, huh, that's interesting. I mean, and you see what we pick up, and it just draws you in and seems fascinating and interesting. I mean, some of the older stuff, the sutras and Dogen's teaching and stuff like that, can be a little more challenging and not something that you're just immediately drawn to, but then you can, take a class, come to a Dharma talk on it, something like that, expose yourself to it in those kinds of ways. But I recommend keeping up some study. Some people absolutely love studying, some people don't, but it's good to just keep on exposing yourself to the teachings gradually. And then they are, there's not a real like, now you get, X amount of stuff you got to cover in a year, but exposing yourself to them gradually, so then they are there, they exist. So even if you forget the exact, where it was or what it was called, there was a teaching on that, and you might be able to return to it when the need arises. And it's important to remember that Buddhist teachings are not about accruing more ideas. They're not about gaining more ideas and concepts and images and philosophical systems or anything like that. I like to think of them as they're all about challenging the ideas you already have. So we already have these ideas about the way the world is, the way we are, the way our mind works, and we're deluded. We're deluded in many ways. So all of the teachings and the practices are really about, getting in there and challenging our ideas and getting us to loosen up our attachment to those views, make our views more nuanced, and maybe even just let go of views even. So let's see. So keeping up a little bit of study at least, even though, I mean, better that you sit zazen and keep the precepts and all that, right? That's the most important part. If you're stu you might be studying too much. If you find yourself neglecting zazen or neglecting embodied practice, or if things start to feel kind of abstract rather than directly relevant or personal. Yeah. And then I guess, in terms of, I like to say it's wrestling with the teachings. So now it's gone a little bit beyond, okay, so now you are studying something, right? You're encountering something in a class, or you've picked it up, you've decided to study it. And I like to think of wrestling. So this is an image that I borrowed from Judaism. So they have an image of, I think it's Jacob, who's wrestling, he wrestles with an angel all night. And no, is it Jacob? I just read it my podcast today. Okay. And then so he wrestles all night with this angel, and then in the morning, like the angel says, ah, you can be called Israel, the one who wrestles with God. And it's like, wrestling with God, that's like, so God wants you to wrestle with him? That's pretty cool. So it's like, we want to engage this stuff. It's not about just going, oh, okay, there's Four Noble Truths and desire leads to suffering. Okay. I mean, that might be helpful at a certain level, but it's not really until we realize this stuff for ourselves, make it real for ourselves, that it means something, that it's actually transformative. So, when you, for instance, one that I struggled with a lot and still do is, okay, everything is empty and boundless and kind of precious just as it is. Really? Well, I'm looking around the world and I'm seeing a lot of stuff that isn't precious just as it is. What the hell are you talking about? I mean, that's, like, wait a second. That's what, And now my Dharma grandmother, Roshi Kennett, would say, you are right to doubt what you think it means. So that's kind of like trusting the Buddha, right? That's trusting ourselves in a way to say, these teachings can't be saying that like the external world is a perfect place of bliss and I shouldn't be worried about it. That, you know, that doesn't make any sense. So what is it saying? So until we really engage that personally, we won't really have delved into the teachings or understood the teachings. And so we have to be honest too, right? That's our like open discussion and questioning of the teachings is always welcome. Like, wait a second. What do you mean about that? That doesn't seem right to me. Questions or comments or something about teachings in general before we go to breakouts? Jinryu.
I loved the list of teachings that you identified in the second link that you shared. I've always been the kind, I like structure and I like I want to know where the path is going as I begin it. And I have become very comfortable without having that now. let me put it this way, much more comfortable than I was. But my question is, and I might be putting things on the wrong plane, but where are the precepts as teachings in your list of teachings?
Well, that's a good question. I guess.
I mean, if the answer is they should be on there, that's okay with me, because traditionally we spend a certain amount of time during the year paying attention to them.
I had never really thought about that, because clearly the precepts, moral, ethical behavior has been there from the beginning, right? It's part of the Eightfold Path. Right behavior, you know, right livelihood, right action, right speech. I guess this betrays my intellectual bent, that I was thinking about teachings as opposed to behavior. But then again, I put the Brahmaviharas on there. I don't know. I guess they could be on there. I don't think they were, they weren't in original Buddhism, they weren't really presented, because that's kind of where I'm getting this list of foundational teachings from. Like, this is what we're studying mostly in this series is going to be the trunk of the tree, right? And then we get a little bit onto the major Mahayana branch. And in original Buddhism, they were just, I don't know if they were so much engaged as teachings and koans the way that we do use them in our Zen lineage, which I think is a really beautiful thing that we do. Any other? Ken. Oh, now you're muted. You just muted yourself.
Good morning. So just for clarification, Domio, you used, I mean, and there's koans in Chan Buddhism and in Rinzai Buddhism, but you also use it sometimes in your Dharma talks and in your one-on-ones. You use koan sort of abstractly to talk about the struggles that we're facing now. Can you just confirm what that analogy is for me? What that means?
Yeah, I mean, that could be a whole like class and talk in and of itself. It's interesting. I'm not sure where this approach really came from. I was raised in the Dharma to think the koan arises in everyday life. And yet I can't really find that written per se explicitly in Chan. I think where it comes from is particularly like Dogen's Genjo Koan. So it's an emphasis on everyday behavior and manifestation. Like that's where the rubber hits the road. How do you wash the dish? How do you respond to your spouse? That is like more important than, you know, going into the sanzen room with the teacher and, you know, doing demonstrating something. Like, how do you demonstrate it every day, every moment? So then we say the koan arises in everyday life, but the koan is still that kind of point of tension, of question. What is this? How does this happen? So it's still a question, but I could go more into that. We should probably go into our breakout rooms. So please, again, if you don't have, you can't think of anything, that's fine. But if you are able to, please share, you know, a teaching that has just been helpful, meaningful to your practice. Hopefully like one that really has been meaningful. And then hopefully we'll come back and just and share a smattering of them so that everybody can hear what came up. So I will recreate. Okay.
Welcome, and I'm so glad to, I mean, I'm new too, but it's fun to watch the other flowers grow.
Thanks for pointing that out, Ken. Indeed. Yeah, so I definitely want to send that message that, yeah, there's no, like, I hope that you will not encounter at any point in this Sangha, like, what? You didn't know the Four Noble Truths? Oh my God. Like, you really, like, there's no minimum knowledge, you know, like showing up and sitting is the, by far the most important thing, you know, like if you want to just show up and sit and skip class, you know, that's fine. But, you know, we have all these teachings, and this is about, like, you know, what's useful and interesting about them. Somebody did ask me a little bit more about, you know, why I use the word wrestling as opposed to just kind of engaging or exploring, investigating, and all these other ways that you could engage with a teaching. And I suppose, you know, all of those are relevant as well. So yeah, I guess my wrestling has to do with, at some point, the most transformative teachings are going to be challenging and uncomfortable, which is why, like, you know, we're not a mega church and why it's like, why I prefer so much of a full tradition like this, as opposed to something new age, which is basically, according to my definition, is, you know, people pick and choose what is, like, what they like. Like, let's just study and talk about what we like and what is kind of affirming or encouraging or pleasant or something like that. And, you know, that's something I did. I actually taught for better, a little over a year, I think. I did a secular Zen night, and I actually, for a while, it was just mindfulness. And And it was really interesting experiment, because I wasn't talking about Zen teachings. We were just talking about mindfulness and whatever. And after a while, I just, you know, I phased that out. But, you know, that's fine for other people to do. For me, I missed these teachings, which are like, what? I mean, they're sometimes hard to grasp, or they're counterintuitive, or they're kind of troubling, perhaps. I mean, just the no self, you know, like your self doesn't exist the way you think it does, is like, what is that? Can any of us really say what that means? And to wrestle with it, engage it, and fight. Maybe other people don't have to fight with this stuff, but I had to really actually fight with this stuff. And sometimes I needed to fight with my teachers, like, about it. I had to, you know, kind of push back on them, like, what is with this? And that was a really valuable process. Any closing questions or comments?
Just as somebody who joined during that Monday mindfulness period, I can say that it was actually observable and borderline hilarious to watch everyone in the room try to talk about Zen without talking about Zen. Because it wasn't just you, it was the other students too.
Yeah. Sam.
I think that the wrestling is appropriate, in that you're never done with the teachings. It's like going back to your quote, I'm going to garble it, of Roshi Kenneth's, of your right to question your understanding. Mm-hmm. In that you're right. You should question the teachings and make them your own, but then you should also question your understanding of the teachings and keep going back and evaluating and learning about them.
Yeah. And just making them real, like somebody in our group said, one of the teachings that intrigued her was Buddha nature. And this is really something to wrestle with, right? What do we have? I have a Buddha nature. Well, then why did I just explode in anger at that person? I mean, really, like, and not in an intellectual way, like, well, theoretically, we're all Buddhas inside, and then this happened, and no, like, what went on? What is that? What is Buddha nature inside of me? What is my Buddha nature? So anyway, I think, the next classes will be on various foundational teachings themselves. And I encourage people to just ask questions and engage those when that happens. So thank you all for being here. I'll close with a verse. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you for being here.
Good night, everybody.
Good night. Thank you.
Night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.